You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
When you're in need of inspiration, join the Potentialist, Maggie Wilde, who will dare you to shine. No matter what challenge life presents, the Potentialist will always help you reconnect to your authentic self, overcome unhelpful habits, reprogram the inner critic, and rewire your mind to attract what you want. With every episode, you'll walk away knowing that you are loved, loving, and lovable. Your time to shine is now. Here's the Potentialist, Maggie Wilde.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's program. You are joining Maggie Wilde, the Potentialist, on the Dare to Shine program on Law of Attraction Radio Network. And, of course, we are here to help you remember that you are loved, you are loving, and you are lovable. And it is time to remember that you are perfect as you are. And yes, we've all got some challenges, and I've actually got a little chat with Janine that I want to talk about that I had during the week. And I'll bring up some topics. Janine, I've asked her if she minds if I share some of the questions that she had with regards to some habits that she was really judging herself on. And we're going to talk today about letting go of cravings, letting go of urges for things like alcohol or sugar, unhelpful substances that have become a little challenging for us, especially during this kind of time in our life where right around the world, everybody is spending more time at home, spending more time with loved ones. Some of us in some countries in lockdown where, you know, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. And I'm really getting a lot of feedback from both clients and listeners who are just saying that things are a little bit more challenging at the moment, and they're resorting or being triggered to go into some old patterns and behaviors, some of which people had thought they'd overcome or that have just slowly started to creep up on them over the course of this last 6 months or so since the world has changed a little bit, or should I say a lot. So what we're going to talk about today is a question that Janine asked me, which was how to stop wanting, and I'll use the example of Janine, which was alcohol. She was craving more than usual alcohol in downtimes of a nighttime, or that it used to be for her around that sort of 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, where it used to creep in for her that she'd think while she was preparing the evening meal, she'd have a little glass of wine. And now, because she's spending more and more time at home, that thought is starting to creep in earlier and earlier throughout the day, and she doesn't like it, and she wanted some help to do that. And she thought that when I asked her permission to share her little story, she thought that that would be inspiring to others to realize that it's not just her, that it's not just you. If that's affecting you or someone you love, that whether it's alcohol, whether it's cigarettes, whether it's even gambling, you know, there are lots of people when they are allowed back into venues, etc., that or there's gambling online now as well, which is just prevalent everywhere. Food, sugars, things like that, cigarettes, etc. So we're going to look at ways to control things that you can do with your beautiful brain to control those habits, cravings, and urges. And talk a little bit about the fact that often we get to a point in our life, if we've done these kind of habits for long periods of time, then we can often get so used to seeing it as part of our identity that we begin to think we're the kind of person who drinks alcohol, or the kind of person who always has to have a cigarette, or the kind of person who can't resist chocolate, or can't resist, sweet snacks or pretzels or whatever it is. And so really what I wanted to talk about today with regards to that is to provide some light on the fact that these habits are simply neural pathways that have been developed in the brain. And good, bad, or indifferent, these habits have become part of our life, but they're not actually who we are. We weren't born having cravings for XYZ. We weren't born a smoker. We weren't born an alcohol, you know, somebody who drinks alcohol. We weren't born a gambler. We learned and developed those experiences. And even if we have, we're part of a genetic lineage that has an addictive kind of gene, we can, through stress triggers, switch that gene on or off as well. So we're not actually victims to addiction. We're not victims to the habits and behaviors and the cravings and the urges anymore. When we know how, we can actually learn how to switch off the cravings and the urges and activate the part of our mind that wants to break free, that wants to take control again and be back in the driving seat of these behaviors and habits. And sometimes it feels as if they've been happening for so long that we've taken on the identity that we are that kind of person, and we're just doomed to always fight with ourselves about alcohol, or fight with ourselves about sugars or gambling or food or whatever it is. And so I'm here today to tell you it's not your fault. It's not who you are. If someone you know and someone you love is struggling with a habit or an addiction that's really challenging them, or indeed if it's yourself, I want you to remember that it's a learned experience in the brain. And the more you play out, if you could see your brain under a microscope, the more you play out certain thoughts and certain behaviors and certain habits, then the brain just assumes, yeah, it just becomes the default process. So under stress, this is you do A or B. If you can retrain your brain when you know how to have a glass of water instead of reach for a chocolate bar, or to take a deep breath instead of, you know, beat yourself up and blame yourself for being addicted to whatever the substance is or the habit is, then your brain can actually learn how to associate better ways and healthier ways that you get to choose. Yep. Now, the key is, and this was just the discussion I had with Janine, was that she got to the point where the urge for alcohol was starting to creep in earlier and earlier throughout the day. And it used to be just when she came home from work and she'd be preparing the evening meal, she might have a glass or two of wine. What was now becoming, because she was spending so much more time at home and she was feeling a little, she was openly admitting that she had begun to feel a little bit more lonely and a little bit more isolated. And so that little wine had crept in a little bit earlier and a little bit earlier. And instead of two or one glasses, it was now two or three, and then it was three or four. And some nights, you know, she was completing the bottle. And that wasn't what she wanted to be. That wasn't the behavior that she wanted to have in her life. And one of the things that she talked about was that the fear of that comfort, the fear of it not being there anymore, was really quite distressing for her. And, you know, it triggered anxiety for her. And so what I want to do today is to help anyone that you know that is going through something like this, to help you understand that the comfort of that behavior or that substance is actually, again, just a learned habit. And we can learn to comfort ourselves through the challenges and learn how to use some very simple brain training techniques to switch off the craving and take control. And I also want to talk about what I call the tipping point, or the moment in your life, and I've certainly experienced this myself, where an unhelpful habit has crept up on you, or you've known that it's been there all along and you've had a battle, an internal battle with you, with yourself, between the part of you that wants to be strong and capable and doesn't want to resort to doing that, and the part of you that surrenders and succumbs in times of stress or in emotion, any kind of emotional trigger. I want you to understand that it's actually not your fault. It's just the proteins in your brain on the neural pathways that have been created around this habit and this urge that have become stronger than you think you are. And our role is to come to a tipping point, a decision point in our life, where we decide that the part of us that wants to be strong and free and capable and able to say no to unhelpful behaviors or behaviors that are making us feel less than our complete selves, if we can reach a point in our lives where the tipping point happens. I'm going to give you an example of this with one of my authors who I will do an interview with in the coming weeks. She's a specialist in addiction and habits. And one of the things that she talks about in her book is that she reached a tipping point in her life she didn't call it that, but it was a moment in her life, a decision point, where she had woken up alone. She'd gone through life under a lot of stress around rejection and feeling alone and isolated. And she woke up in South Africa one year, many, many years ago, and she'd been in a relationship that had ended quite poorly, and she was originally from New Zealand. And so she was in a completely other part of the world, all alone. She'd broken up with this person that she thought she was in love with, and she'd had a habit around alcohol that had just kind of escalated through her teens and into her 20s, and to the point where alcohol had not only become her social behavior, but had become all of her emotional comfort as well. And she woke one morning and reached for a plastic tumbler of red wine, and it was 7 a.m. in the morning. And she said she remembers lying in the bed holding this tumbler of wine, and the part of her that had always been strong, the part of her that had always wanted something better for herself, and who had witnessed, you know, immense levels of addiction, generational addiction in her family as she grew up, had, the part of her that had always tried to be better for herself and break the habits around that, popped into her mind as she went to take a swig of this plastic tumbler of red wine. And that part of her said, I want more than this. And she remembered being a young girl in amongst a lot of isolation and a lot of loneliness, who had always wanted to be the best at everything, who had always wanted to, even as a young girl, she started businesses and, you know, a magazine round that she used to do, and started ways to earn money and always had goals and visions, always had the most buttons and awards from brownies or girl guides, etc. And so that part of her, the voice popped into her mind and just asked her, what did she want for the rest of her life? Did she want to be the kind of person who drowned her sorrows in this alcohol, who woke feeling miserable for the rest of her life? Or did she want something more? And if so, what was she going to do about it? And that glass of, or that cup, that plastic tumbler of wine in her hand became the tipping point for her. And in that moment, she realized she wanted more than that. And she knew it was going to be hard, and she knew that she was alone, and, you know, she was in a country where she didn't know anyone. She didn't have any money to get back to her home. There, you know, there was a lot going against her in that point, and she knew that she'd been drowning her sorrows for those past weeks since the breakup, and that she didn't want to do that anymore. And so the part of her that had wanted that betterness for herself, that potential for herself, put the wine down and poured out the cask of wine, threw away the tumbler, and decided that morning that that was her tipping point. That was her decision moment. And her life, she never looked back. And right till this point, you know, 20 years later, I've just been working with her for the last 6 months or so, producing her book, which is called Is It a Habit or an Addiction? And her whole point in life had become to be that better version of herself. And it wasn't until years later that she became a therapist herself and helped people through addictions and generational habits and addictions. And her book, which is called Is It a Habit or an Addiction, is actually about that. It's about finding the ways to find that decision point, that point where we decide for ourselves that we want something better for ourselves, and that we don't have to do it alone, that there is a lot of help out there for us to do that. And so what I'd like to do today is to help you, or someone you love, if there's someone you love that you think might benefit from using some of these techniques we're going to be talking about today, then I would love for you to share this with them as well. But we're going to just do some very, very simple brain training interruptions to urges and cravings, and give us the chance for whatever it is, whether it's gambling or cigarettes or sugar or biscuits or cookies or alcohol or whatever it is, that no matter how hard it feels in the moment, if you can find the courage to have a little decision point just before you succumb to having whatever or doing whatever that thing is, one tiny little decision point to do a brain training interruption, a pattern interruption in your brain to make a different decision in that moment, that little decision point, it may not be the decision point that ends up stopping the habit altogether. But one tiny decision point to stop the craving today, and another tiny little decision point to stop the craving tomorrow, and if it happens next week and the week after and the week after, at some point, there's a part of you that feels so much stronger and is able to come to that big tipping point, that big moment where you go, you know what, I'm going to put this habit down forever. I'm going to break up with the habit of having that habit. Yeah. And what I'd like you to do today is not see these strategies as the total solution, that you're never going to crave this thing again, or you're never going to have the desire to do this thing again. What I'm asking you to do is see it as a little bit of confidence, a little bit of hope that you have just one little thing that you could do. And your job, your only job, is to decide as you're experiencing the craving or the urge, or as you're nearing the moment where you normally have the habit happen, such as for Janine, it's that was the 5 p.m. kind of urge for a glass of wine, and it had actually come back during the day to a 3 p.m. So when those thoughts come in for the sugar or the habit or the whatever it is, that you make a decision to do this first. And it's literally as simple as this, and I've talked about it in previous episodes. It's actually initially just an eye roll. That's it. Nothing more, nothing more than that. Just simply stop, make a decision to blink three times and do an eye roll, which is simply blink, 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 and roll your eyes in a big circle to the right, and roll your eyes in a big circle to the left, and take a deep breath, breathing in and breathing out. So if we do that again, we literally blink, 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 roll one way and roll back the other and take a deep breath. It takes all of a few seconds, but I promise you, just by doing that little, it's called in therapeutic terms, a pattern interruption. So just by doing that little technique, and deciding, the key is to decide to do it. The power that you have is to decide to do that. I'm not asking you to decide to put the cigarette down. I'm not asking you to decide to put the wine down. I'm not asking you to decide to put the sugar down or the cookie down or the biscuit. All I'm asking you is to decide to blink, roll your eyes, and breathe. And just by doing that decision, not having to find the courage to put the wine down or find the courage to say no to the pretzels. The decision is purely to blink, roll your eyes, and breathe. That's it. By doing that, the urge and the craving for whatever it is will be diminished, okay? So if, for instance, prior it was on a scale of 0 to 10, the urge was a 10 and you were really fighting with yourself, and the more you fought and the more you tried to resist, unfortunately, that triggers the brain into stress, and the urge and the craving used to be the solution according to the brain. So the brain would be pre-programmed to make the urge or the craving stronger. So your job is not to say, I can't have the cigarettes, or I can't have the chocolate, or I can't have the wine. Your job is not to fight with it anymore. Your job is not to find the willpower. Your job is not to try and build up the courage. Your job is just simply to decide to blink, roll your eyes, and breathe. Nothing more. And when you do that, I promise you, the level of intensity of that urge or that craving will have diminished. So the decision is not about will I drink or will I finish the bottle or will I have another cigarette. The decision is simply will I blink, yeah, roll, and breathe. And when you get more and more used to making that decision first, the effort it takes to say no to the other stuff is actually effortless. There is far less effort that needs to happen. So if there's far less effort that needs to happen to make the decision to put the food or the substance down, then we're no longer triggering the stress response, the fight and flight in the brain. Now, remember, our beautiful brain is programmed to protect us. It breathes for us while we're asleep. It helps us, you know, freeze if there's somebody that's about to stab us, or run if we're capable of doing that. It allows us to protect ourselves in any way possible. And it's pre-programmed and has been for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But our job is to recognize that some of those stress triggers are really, really helpful to us, but some of them have become habitual idiosyncrasies that cause us internal discomfort, internal stress. It causes us to doubt ourselves. It causes us to beat ourselves up. It causes us to be disappointed in ourselves. And all of that triggers the stress response, because our brain doesn't know the difference between an emotional stress like that, and which is, you know, can be a self-imposed stress because it's our internal dialogue and our internal judgments on ourselves, and the stress between, you know, being attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. The brain doesn't differentiate the two. All it does is recognize you are in distress, and so it triggers the stress response. And if your pattern up till this point has been to comfort yourself with food, alcohol, pretzels, wine, whatever it is, gambling, then the brain, yeah, is just doing what it thinks is going to help you, which is cause the craving. The more you fight with that, so if you continue to try and resist the craving and beat yourself up because you're having the craving, then you're just causing more and more distress to the brain, and the brain is just more and more believing that you are in danger, and it is triggering the cravings more. And so they just get stronger, and you end up in this kind of tug of war battle between yourself and yourself. Yep. The part of you that wants the freedom and the healthy choice and to follow through on the decision you made last week not to drink again, and the part of you that uses it to comfort yourself or calm yourself, or it might be just not even an emotional thing. It might be just habitual. You've gotten so used to the 3 o'clock glass of wine or the 5 o'clock cigarette or whatever it is. So what we want to do is stop the fight. That's the first thing, is to recognize, let's stop the fight. Let's not make a decision about whether we're going to ever drink again or whether we're going to ever smoke again right now. In the moment that the urge or the craving happens, all we're going to decide is to blink, roll our eyes, and breathe. And then the magic happens. So whether the craving or the urge intensity drops on a scale of 0 to 10 from a 10 to an 8, or from a 10 to a 2, it's different for everyone. And sometimes you might need to blink, roll your eyes, and breathe 4 or 5 times. Sometimes you might need to add something else to it, like the brain training recipes that we've been doing in the past few weeks, or some other techniques we're going to teach you now as well. But by making a decision to do that, that's your only decision. And I think that simplifies everything. It takes the pressure away from you from having to decide right now to become the sober person, or decide right now to become the smoke-free person, or decide right now to do anything. Yeah, because all of that is just creating more stress, which is increasing the cycle. Our decision, our only responsibility in the moment, is to decide whether to, you got it again, what are you going to do? You're going to blink, roll your eyes, and breathe. So let's do it again. Let's think about it right now. Think about something that you have, and it can happen whether you have the craving or not. If you conjure up the last time you remembered wanting to do this unhelpful habit, or if you think about now that your kind of food, that your go-to food, your go-to stress food, or your go-to food that you eat too much of that's not helping your body, that you fight with yourself internally about, then just think about whatever that habit is, whatever that food is, whatever that behavior is that you fight with yourself about. I want you to think about it now. Notice on a scale of 0 to 10 how much you like it or how much you fight with it, what the reaction is. Yep. And then simply decide to blink, 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 blink. Roll your eyes in a big circle one way. Roll them back. And take in a deep breath. And try breathing in through your nose and out through your mouth when you do that. So it's breathing in And breathe out for longer than you breathe in. And just see how you feel. If you then try and think about that food, that habit, that battle that you normally have, what happens in your head? It's just be curious about it. It's less intense. Everyone will, you'll experience it in a very, very different way. But for some people, they describe it, it just feels like it's less intense. Other people use language around, it feels like it's further away from them. It feels like it's distanced from them. Remember in some of our previous brain training recipes or in our shape shift brain training recipe we do that we've done in previous sessions, I think in session two, in episode two, we did that technique. We can describe it as it feels like it's outside of ourselves, separate, we're distanced from it. Or some people describe it as just less intense. Some people say they can't even find the urge or the craving. They kind of search through their brain and can't find it. I just want you to be curious for yourself about what happens for you. It'll be different for you. It'll be your own unique way of doing it. There's no right or wrong. And if you're unsure, I'm happy for you to message me. You can contact me at info@thepotentialist.com or you can subscribe to the channel and we'll make sure that we answer any questions that you have. But the point is not to go into the fear about letting go of this habit, not to go into the worry about what I'm going to do without it. The stress around, am I going to cope or will I be able to follow through or I've disappointed myself. If you go down that path, the change will be harder and harder to make. And the brain will be just trying to trigger the cravings more or the urges more because it thinks you're in a stressful state. Your job is to simply decide. What is it? To decide in the moment. Do I pick up the cigarette or do I pick up the pretzel or do I pick up the cookie or do I pick up the donut or do I pick up the chocolate or do I pick up the glass of wine or do I go down and gamble or whatever it is, or do I just blink, roll my eyes and breathe? Step one. That's all you need to decide. After that, of course, there are many, many more things we can do. But in the moment when a craving is really, really happening or when an urge is present, then the challenge becomes it's too big a challenge. I think that's the challenge. The challenge becomes it's too big a challenge to just put away the habit altogether. Some people can just decide cold turkey, that's it, I'm never going to do it again. But for others, it's deeply ingrained or there are multiple layers of stress in their life that it's just too big a decision to make. But I promise you, if you make the decision to just blink, roll your eyes and breathe this time and next time, there will come a point, whether it's tomorrow, whether it's in a month or whether it's in 5 months' time, you will be gradually removing. And again, if we could see it under a microscope in your brain, you will be reducing the proteins on the neural pathways for that habit, and you'll be strengthening the proteins on the neural pathway for the hope and the belief in yourself that you can control this. And there'll be a tipping point. And everyone's tipping point will come at a very, very different time. Doing this once might be the tipping point for you and it changes everything because it proves to you you've got the power. It might be 3 times. It might be 10 times. It might be 100 times. It might be 6 months of times as your brain builds up the proteins on that new neural pathway of being free of that habit to the point where one day the tipping point is, it's not about taking the craving away. The tipping point is, I don't need the habit anymore. And you make a decision like, you know, this author that I told you about, Juanita, where she put the wine down. She poured out the cask. She tipped out the tumbler of wine and she decided in that moment to become the person she'd always hoped she would be. And that didn't come through one decision. She'd been thinking for months, years prior to that, about the part of herself that wanted more for herself. And a lot of us, if we've ever experienced an unhelpful habit in our past before that we wanted to overcome, a lot of us will agree that there's a point where we've been thinking about it in the back of our mind. Yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And we might have made many attempts, even sought out lots and lots of different help to overcome it. And maybe it worked. Maybe it worked for short times. Maybe it worked permanently. Or maybe it crept back in over time or got triggered by a stressful experience. What matters is that that tail end voice that has been hopeful, that there's a point where you're going to make a decision. There's a point where there will be the day that you decide enough is enough. And I call it the tipping point, the enough is enough moment, where you go, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. But it's not done from stress. It's not done with a fight. It's not done, that decision point of enough is enough isn't done from the trauma and the stress of having to give up or lose something. It's a peaceful enough. It's kind of a relief. Enough is enough. There's a language when you use the words enough is enough in your brain, and it is the moment that is your tipping point. Then there's a peacefulness around that. There's a, it's kind of like, oh, I get it. Enough is enough. It's my time. It's time for the part of me that wants this freedom to really shine. Now, that doesn't mean you'll never have a craving again. Of course, it means that the part of you that wants the freedom has reached the tipping point, that the proteins on that neural pathway is far stronger than the proteins on the addiction or the habit or the craving. And so your job is just to then love yourself back to health, to love yourself so much and accept yourself so much that you're willing to continue using the brain training recipes, rolling the eyes, breathing, blinking, doing the shape shifts, doing the brain training recipes, doing everything that we can teach you in order to take control and find that freedom. And that's the key. It's about finding the freedom. So just a reminder, in our next part of the show today, we have a special guest by the name of Michelle Robinson, who is a spiritualist teacher, a spiritualist coach. And she has an amazing book called Intuitive Gifts at Work. And she's going to talk lots about those of you who want to work more with your intuitive gifts, and that's coming up in the second half of the program, remember, as well. So stay tuned for that. So we're going to end this part of the program with just another reminder of a couple of little things that you can do. Of course, we've talked about the decision point is not to say I'm never going to have alcohol again or cigarettes or biscuits or whatever it is at that point. The decision is simply I'm going to do a blink, a roll, and a breath. Yeah. One of the other things you can do, if that isn't enough for the craving at that point to completely go, is a version of, if anyone's ever done any emotional freedom work, any emotional freedom tapping, a version of that is to simply either rub or tap on the tips of the fingers and just say enough is enough. So that in itself is another pattern interruption. And so you can either decide that you're going to blink, roll the eyes and breathe, and then rub on the tips of each of the fingers and the thumb as you say, enough is enough. That's all you need to do. Just rub on the ends of those fingers and thumbs as you say, enough is enough. So what I normally do is just rub on the side of the nail. So as if you're holding the tip of your finger by the sides and just rubbing on both of the sides of that finger, as I say, enough is enough. And that in itself is going to add a little bit more freedom, a little bit more space in your brain to decide something different as well. So I hope that's been helpful to you. Remember, your job is to just decide, not to never do that thing again at the moment. And this might be your tipping point. This might be your moment. This might be enough for you to say never again, okay? But don't beat yourself up about that if that is not where it is right now. It is not your fault that you've developed this. It's because you didn't know what to do, that you didn't have the skills prior to this to take charge of how your brain was triggering those cravings and urges. Your job is to now decide just that. I'm going to do a blink, an eye roll, and a breath, or I'm going to rub on the tips of my fingers and say, enough is enough. And by doing those things, you're going to create a space, 3, 4, 5, 6 seconds in your brain where you can no longer think about the intensity of that craving anymore. And the urge for it is just nowhere near as strong. And in that moment, you can put your attention on something else. Put your attention on something healthy, joyful, loving. Put your attention on the last time you remembered picking up one of your kids or your grandchildren and giving them a big hug, or the last time you remembered going for a walk or seeing a sunset, or the last time you did something absolutely joyful for yourself, or took yourself out for a cup of coffee, or did something that for you was about peacefulness, joy, and happiness. And the key to it all is to decide the simplest decision that you can make is not about the habit or the addiction right now. The simplest decision you can make is to do something to give you a moment of freedom, a moment of peace. And that moment of peace is to still your mind and let go of the challenge between the two parts of yourself, the part that wants it, the part that doesn't. And when you let go of that challenge, the battle, then the trigger normally goes away. The craving normally reduces and you have some space in your brain to make a different choice. So I hope that's been incredibly helpful. Remember, stay tuned. Part two today is a amazing author by the name of Michelle Robertson, and she's going to talk you through working with your intuitive gifts and ways in which to do that. She's got some amazing tips and strategies, an amazing lady. Hugs to you all. Remember, I am Maggie Wild, the Potentialist, and it is time for you to dare to shine.
You're listening to Law of Attraction Radio Network, enhancing the well-being of millions of listeners worldwide. LOARadionetwork.com is heard through 25 different internet radio stations, as well as iTunes Radio, Stitcher.com, and our mobile apps. The Law of Attraction Radio Network, your trusted source of daily inspiration at LOARadionetwork.com.
Welcome back to the show, and this part of the show we have our amazing special guest, the beautiful Michelle Robertson, who I've had the pleasure of knowing actually for a number of years now, but working really, really closely with you in this last year on your amazing book, which we're going to talk about later. So, Michelle, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, Maggie, and welcome to all the listeners who are with us today. Look, I've written a book that's all about helping intuitive practitioners to really shine when they use their intuitive gifts. It's something I'm very passionate about, and it's been the topic that's been close to my heart now for more than 30 years, the finding of the inner essence that we call our own spirituality and using it as a way to really connect with what our life's about, our life's purpose, and then how we can share that with others so that they also feel healing and hope and a sense of upliftment. So yes, it's about helping intuitive practitioners build their confidence and their competence to be the very best they can be, and in a really good ethical framework, which is so important.
And so by intuitive practitioners, do you mean just psychics and mediums and people working in that profession, or do you mean kinesiologists and acupuncturists and so, who are using their intuition as well, counsellors, etc.? How wide does it go?
That's a great question. Actually, my background is mainstream. I was a teacher for most of my life, studied degrees also in counselling and hypnotherapy. And so I was able to integrate my intuitive gifts into my mainstream work. And so this book does teach the skills and also the confidence to begin to expand whatever a person may be currently doing if they have a yearning to bring some intuition into their work. It gives them confidence and skills to be able to apply it in any area. But having said that, it does target those, I guess, who are wanting to work with their gifts full time, to be able to bring that into some kind of professional practice. And whether that's just starting to step up and do it on a small scale, or whether someone's already doing it and wants to really shine and lift their ability even higher, the book targets all of those people.
Because I know, having known you for a long time and worked with you in the therapeutic environment as well, you have very, very strong ethical guidelines with the way you work, and you translate those ethical guidelines into the spiritual field as well, which I think has been very lacking in a lot of areas. So I love this aspect of what you do. Tell us a bit about that.
Absolutely. Look, I actually come very deeply from a place where intention is the core of everything. And it doesn't matter what we do, Maggie. You know, a person can be working in the most non-spiritual, and I say that with the inverted commas around, non-spiritual field in terms of what others may think. And yet they can have a deeply spiritual connection to themselves and to everyone that they're working with. And so when we come from an intention of compassion, then anything we do is a form of healing, and we can hold vibration that has a healing vibration for those around us. And so this book is very much about sharing the central core that our intention to be, I guess, bringers of healing and hope through compassion is what gives us the very best blend with spirit, because believe me, they want the best for humanity and our planet. So to improve our connections, our intention and our ethics are absolutely core. You can't fool spirit. You might fool some people if you're just doing it for money, but I assure you spirit won't be there supporting you in the same way as if you come from a deep place of wanting to help.
Absolutely. And tell us a little bit, because I know there's a lot of people that struggle to combine the intuitive work, if they've been working in more mainstream therapy and counseling, and then there's the part of themselves that has that calling to come out, if you like, kind of come out of the closet and talk about the way that they connect with their client, and why they get such good results is because they're either acting from a place of mediumship, where they're getting, you know, messages from external, or they're acting from a place of psychic. So how do you help practitioners come out of the closet and talk about it in a way that is being true to themselves?
Absolutely. Look, if a practitioner feels that this is their calling, they'll know, Maggie. It's not something that I have to convince anybody about. When you know that your soul is asking you to step up, or even just to take some courage and begin to explore with our clients or with those around us that there's more to life, that there's more meaning and purpose in life, no one needs any persuasion about that. It's like the quiet voice. It's an urge within that really can't be contained. And the other thing I would say about that is that we need to think about what is the person's deepest need. So, you know, there are some clients who really don't want to hear about this stuff, and that's absolutely their right. It's not our job to force our beliefs on anyone. But if there is a need, and if they are open to receiving some intuitive insights, then that's where I think that little chink of light is there where we can do our work. So it comes down to the client's rights and what they are seeking, but also, of course, for an intuitive practitioner, there comes a point you just can't deny that calling, that feeling that they need to do something. You just can't deny it forever. And that's certainly what happened to me.
Yeah. So tell us, how did that happen? What happened for you?
Well, I guess it was a major discovery for me to step into this field in quite a dramatic way, because although I'd been searching for answers to a lot of the, struggles in my young life, and I was a seeker and wanted to know how to make sense of the world, like many, many people, there was, you know, trauma there. And so I was always seeking and praying and not finding myself in that, always hoping for an external answer. What happened in the early 1990s is that my husband, my then husband, and I bought an old Queenslander. Now, in Australia, an old Queenslander is an old wooden house in a suburb in Harvey Bay where we were living. And to my amazement, there was a spirit of a man residing in that house. So we had a visitor that we had no knowledge.
Because obviously up until that point, you hadn't been working in this field.
No.
So how did you know it was that spirit? What, tell us about that.
Okay. So it was really quite amazing for me. It was life-changing, actually. And I think that people who get involved in this often have a life-changing moment where they're desperately seeking answers. To be honest, I had depression and anxiety at this time, and I had joined a meditation group, a spiritual meditation group, hoping to find a way to calm myself and to find spiritual answers within. And I was also very curious because, in a not so pleasant way, my dearly loved grandmother had died suddenly on the morning of my wedding. And so this particular day, when I lay on my bed in this new home, a newly purchased home, it was an old home, and opened up to the spirit world as I'd been told to do in my meditation group.
So you were trying to communicate to your grandmother, was that right?
Yes, yes. Yep. Well, basically, I think I said something like, "Hello, is anyone there? Is anyone there who can help me?" And it's like opening up your front door, you know, and saying to everyone in the neighborhood, "Why don't you drop by?" And what happened was I suddenly felt a very physical warm energy vibrate very strongly near my right shoulder, which was the side closest to the edge of the bed. And I heard in my head a male voice, and he said, "Don't worry, I won't hurt you." And I leapt off that bed. I can tell you, I leapt off that bed and I retreated from that bedroom. And I thought, what on earth is going on? And I had to seek advice from the spiritual leader who was teaching my meditation group. And she was able to confirm that it was a male spirit who lived in the house. But it was further meditation that actually showed me when I saw him, he was in a pilot's uniform. And I thought, I don't understand that. However, one neighbor on the left-hand side had been in the neighborhood for a long time. And he could tell me that a previous owner of our home was indeed a pilot who died in a light plane crash. And I was able to identify who he was. And I got all the microfiche, that's that very old newspaper records of his crash. So I found his name and all of that kind of thing. And so a relationship, I guess, developed from there while my mind was blown wide open. My belief system was blown wide open. I'd gone from thinking, you know, this life that wasn't making any sense to me, that had been traumatic, and then my marriage was in trouble, wasn't making any sense. All of a sudden, there was life after death, and that changed everything.
That's actually a really important comment there, because I know we've talked before, and one of the things that you said in your early years was that you'd lost hope. You didn't know if there was anything after death that you know, and part of your anxiety and depression was about this kind of emptiness that you felt.
Yeah.
So this was a real pivot moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was the single most incredible and life-changing thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. Obviously, having children and love the people that I love in my life is, you know, the single most important thing. But I would have to be honest and say, in my whole life, the one thing that gave me the sense of purpose and connection to my life, and later the connection to my spiritual team, the connection to what I believe is the God force, whatever name you want to call it, the source, the divine light, doesn't matter, that great power, all of that came in an authentic way from that moment. Because before that, it had just been our Sunday school teaching and Bible reading. And I'd given that up, to be honest, in my 20s, because nothing seemed to be helping me with my trauma. But finding my own spirit, a connection to my soul, knowing that healing and sharing the message about the importance of life and valuing ourselves, that gave me a new sense of purpose. And I've been firmly on that route for more than 30 years now, even though I worked mainstream during that time until about the last 5 years or so, I was doing both. But now I just teaching spirituality, spiritual development, and of course, writing my books.
And you've traveled the world, haven't you, with some of the leading schools around the world that take mediumship to a whole nother level. And talk a little bit about your journey with regards to developing your skills.
Yes. So I did as much as I could do in Australia. Well, that's not fair. I mean, there's always more we can do. But I studied with some great teachers in Australia. And then I heard about this college in England called the Arthur Findlay College. And it's a college which is very much about working for the closer relationship between the spirit world, so spirit, and humans for the purpose of bringing healing to grieving people. So very much about mediumship is about providing messages of hope that there is evidence of life after death. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what the Arthur Findlay College does, but it does so much more. I studied trance healing there, which is really my passion, to be honest. I'm a trance medium, first and foremost. And it was reading Brian Weiss's book many, many years ago, early in my journey, Many Lives, Many Masters, in which he was receiving messages from not just the his hypnosis client who was experiencing past lives, but in the middle of these sessions with his client, Brian Weiss found himself talking to highly evolved spiritual guides or spiritual beings who were giving him messages about his life and about humanity. And what I'd never known is that when I dissociate and sit and ask questions in a meditative state, I'd been receiving those sorts of messages. And when I read that book and I felt the energy of those words of wisdom, something in me just absolutely woke up. And I knew that continuing to be that channel for spiritual wisdom is the reason I'm here, and sharing that with others so that they can also find whatever little piece it is that is important for them. We all have different callings, different
gifts and ways of sharing.
Absolutely, yes. And no one way is better than the other. It's we just need to follow our own unique sort of path, I guess. Sorry, Maggie.
Sorry, I just want to actually introduce your book, actually, Your Intuitive Gifts at Work, which is just, you know, I had the privilege of editing this book, and in all the kind of books that are on this genre that I've read over the years or had the privilege to edit, this book gave a real sense of order and structure. Yes, which is sometimes lacking.
I'm a teacher, so I couldn't help that.
Exactly. Well, it's a great gift because it's certainly something new to this industry. It's not something I've ever read before in this industry, which is fabulous. And you've given a real structure to not only recognizing your gifts and helping you determine which are your strength gifts, because there's so many subtleties between psychic, between medium, transmedium, you know, all the different layers of that and where the message is coming from. And you really talk in the book about how to tap into which one is kind of your leading gift. And obviously you can cross-pollinate as well. But it gave real structure to then not just the techniques and the skills, but the ethics around setting up a practice, the marketing of that practice. Like it's a huge wealth of business. So I'm just going to read a little bit from an extract from the back, and then we'll talk a little bit about the eight keys, which are really important, because it is Your Intuitive Gifts at Work, From Passion to Profession, the eight keys to excellence of spiritual practice. And so Michelle says on the back, whether you want to establish a professional practice or simply practice like a professional, this book lets you master the keys to excellence. This book was written for those of you who feel called to share your intuitive gift, an urge from the soul to step up. But your mind often worries, what if?
Absolutely.
A yearning to make your passion your profession. And so from the perspective of the author of the book, tell us a little bit about those eight keys.
Absolutely. Look, I always say that spirituality begins with us. And I mean that absolutely from my heart. What was lacking for me before I found spirituality, my spirituality, was it was external. I was seeking guidance always from external authority figures. But really, it does come down to us. And so the first key is about, I call it the alchemy of personal empowerment, but it really is about our mind power and stepping into our confidence and having the confidence to put our worries and fears of not being good enough, what will people think of me, put those things aside and to adopt, I guess, and make authentic a new confident version of ourselves that is able to step up and to do the things that we would choose to do in our intuitive work. The second key is very much about energy management. And energy management is about how do we work without finding that we have lost our energy? How do we sustain that? And how do we, because, you know, the world can seem overwhelming. Our sensitivities can seem overwhelming in shopping centres, in bright lights, in all sorts of ways. And so and it helps
that
us.
That chapter as well, like there's a lot of talk around, you know, people being afraid of doing this work because they're not protected and so on. And there's a lot of myths around that. There's a lot of different opinions. How do you approach that?
Yeah. So what I do is I sort of dispel the myths that might be around spirituality, such as it's not safe to work properly, or that, you know, the spirit world is going to come and take over us and do bad things to us.
It's very your little pussycat has popped in. How beautiful. What boy or girl? What's her name? His name?
It's a little girl. Yes, it's a little girl, and she shouldn't be here.
She's allowed.
Sorry she about
could
that.
Be your, she could be your familiar. You never know.
Yes, she could be. I didn't realise she was wandering the house. Yes, so it's amazing, isn't it? You know, we get set up for these things and the things that can happen still. That's life at the moment, isn't it?
It that is life and it's okay.
We're living in unexpected times. Yes, so energy management. And yes, there's stuff there about protection, and what it takes is simply your positive intention to lift your energy and connect only with the positive things, positive energies. That's a very strong protection.
And of course, it's the choice, is it? So it's when you go into the fear and start believing the myths, that's when your energy gets weakened. And so it's having that strength gives you the strength and the protection. Beautiful.
And more than that, we need different energies for different types of work, like psychic work and mediumship work requires a high vibration and a high energy. Trance work, we need to be very passive. We need to let spirit work with us and let it and step to one side. So managing our energy is also part of that chapter.
And what about the ego in that? Because, you know, there's being able to step to one side and let spirit do the work. Tell me about that.
So this is in trance. Mind you, in anything, if you have trust in spirit and in your spiritual guides, then the ego really does need to step to one side, because otherwise the risk is that we're just reproducing our mind chatter. Now, it's really important that we have mindfulness and not mindfulness, because mindfulness means that we are maybe telling our clients what's in our life or what's in our mind. But when we are able to have a clear intention and focus for what we're doing, and also then ask for spiritual guidance, lift and clear our energy, that's when our intuition can really work. And that is one of the keys, actually, of excellent energy management, is having a full energy field, sitting in our own spiritual power and believing that we are working, and because we are, only with the best and highest energies. That protects from anything that might be, you know, out there that people are worried about. And there's plenty of information on that in the book.
And thank you to the amazing Michelle Robinson. That was amazing, Michelle. Thank you. If you'd love to contact Michelle personally, you can reach out to her on her website, which is academyofspiritualpractice.com. Or, of course, you can reach her on her Facebook group, which she does some free readings for quite regularly during the week as well, which is Intuitive Gifts at Work. And, of course, her book is Intuitive Gifts at Work. So contact Michelle at her Facebook group, Intuitive Gifts at Work, or at the website, academyofspiritualpractice.com. You've been listening to Maggie Wild, the Potentialist, on Dare to Shine, Law of Attraction Radio Network. And remember, it is time for you to unleash your potential and dare to shine. You are loved, you are loving, and you are lovable.
Thanks for joining Maggie Wild, the Potentialist. We'll be back next week with another great episode. Please visit Maggie at thepotentialist.com.